Morning, everyone. I want to welcome everyone to Grand Rounds. Couple things first before I forget. In terms of the attendings and those that are submitting for CME credit, you must fill out your evaluations. Evidently, there are some people that aren't filling out their evaluations and are having trouble getting their credit for it. And as you know, it goes through the state. We automatically send the credits through, so please make sure you're filling that out. And the residents, too, obviously it's important to know how you all feel, so don't forget to fill out your evaluations. One other housekeeping thing, in a couple weeks, the last weekend of this month, March 29th, 30th, and 31st, is the annual update in internal medicine that's going to be held at the Marriott over Royal Military Trail near the mall. It's a Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, Sunday morning, and we've got a couple really big keynote speakers, so please attend that. Anyways, this morning it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Sidney Brayman, who is a master of the College of Chest Physicians and professor of medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Dr. Brayman has been involved in pulmonary medicine for many years, and he did his fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania in Walter Reed after completing a residency and internship at Philadelphia General Hospital and doing his medical degree at Temple. He is one of the national leaders in COPD guidelines, and this morning he's going to give us an update on the COPD guidelines. It is my pleasure.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and it's wonderful to be here. My introduction to this hospital and the medical school attached to this hospital came a year or two ago when I realized that there was a residency program in internal medicine here, and offered to have your internal medicine residents attend a yearly conference that I've been running now for, this is I think the fifth or sixth year, over at the Breakers in Palm Beach. The conference is called the Eastern Pulmonary Conference, and it really brings down to this region leading experts from mostly the East Coast to talk about a whole slew of things in pulmonary medicine, critical care medicine, and so forth. We also have a competition that we run, cash competition, for the residents who submit either a clinical abstract or a research abstract, two different categories. And your residents here have been participants and winners, I must say. So we'll certainly extend that invitation again year after year after year. It's really been, it's a great, great conference, and I think they really appreciated it. And thank them for their support. So today I'm going to be talking about COPD. And in discussing with the residents, I have had the pleasure of coming down previously, and I have plans to meet with them over the next few months. I have a home not far from here, and it's a great excuse to get away from New York City and spend some weekend at my home and then meet with the residents on a Thursday afternoon. And in discussing with them sort of what might I speak about here at Boca Regional, we talked about a lot of topics, and one that just kept coming up had to do with COPD, and particularly the government's attitude about COPD and readmissions for COPD. As you know, or may not, hospitals are now being penalized if their readmission rates for COPD are too high. By the way, that's also true for heart failure, coronary artery disease, and so forth. So in view of this, I thought it would be a nice thing to review COPD, and particularly since there have been some major changes in our guideline approach to COPD that I'll discuss today. I do have some disclosures. I do some non-promotional talking, lectures, and I have been a consultant in research directions in a few companies you see here. So here's the learning objectives. We'll outline the changes to the most recent GOLD guidelines, and I'll discuss what they are. Access to the new definition of COPD, very curious little word was slipped into a disease definition. Just quietly place the word in. I'll show you what it was, and it made a major change to our thinking about COPD. We'll talk about guideline-approved practice strategies to stage and treat COPD, and then talk lastly about the exacerbation of COPD. So this is what's happened. During certainly my tenure in the latter part of the 20th century, we were doing a great job in exercise and diet control and cholesterol control and high blood pressure control. Wonderful, wonderful things were happening in the public health arena. But look what happens with coronary disease and stroke as a result. Wonderful. The incidence of death was going down. At the same time, COPD was rising, a meteorite rise of 163% of deaths from COPD. We were really asleep at the wheel. I think we all knew what the problem was, but we were certainly, as a nation, ignoring it. Well, many of us know what COPD is. COPD is the pink puffer, the blue bloater. Remember these guys, pink puffer, blue bloater. This is what we learned COPD was. Well, indeed, the Marlboro man came and went, often dying of lung cancer or COPD. But in his place came this woman and this woman. And during the latter part of the 20th century, what was happening is the number of women actually outstripped the number of men smoking, and by 2002, I think it was, for the first time, more women were dying of COPD, more women had COPD, more women, actually it turns out, are more susceptible to getting COPD. Nobody knows why, and one of the theories is just smaller lungs. You take a cigarette and you put it into a small space as opposed to a larger space. That may not be true, but certainly we know that women nowadays, and indeed you all know from hospital admissions that you see as many women as men with COPD, and this was the epidemic that was created. Well, in 1996, the World Health Organization, in sensing this meteorite rise in COPD deaths, decided that we got to do something. And they sent a group of public health people and economists and bankers, all types of people, to look at the global impact of health and projected it over the next 20 years, as they do every 20 years. And sure enough, what do they find? COPD would continue to rise, and worldwide this is, and become the third leading cause of death. Sadly enough, several years ago, we reached that horrible milestone as a third leading death in this country. So it is a big, big public health issue. So as a result of that World Health and Organization study, the experts got together and said, we got to do something and create some roadmaps, guidelines for recognition of COPD, treatment of COPD, standards for treating COPD. And that's exactly what happened. The guideline is called the GOLD guideline, G-O-L-D. I'll refer to it a number of times during this discussion. And as you see, it's the G-O-L-D, Global Initiative on Obstructive Lung Disease, put out by the World Health Organization and also the NIH here. So this was, and you see there, 2017, there's a 2018, now there'll soon be a 2019 report. Now it's being, there's so much research going on, it's being updated pretty much every year. And we'll talk about the changes over the last couple of years. So what happened with that epidemic? Well, in this country, 15 million patients have COPD. Look at that, certainly well more than half are diagnosed by the primary care physician. 30 to 40 some percent receive spirometry to confirm a diagnosis. This is actually a major difficulty we have. And I know that you've seen patients admitted to the hospital age 75, 80. And you look at the patient and say, oh, gee, how long have you had your COPD? My what? Never diagnosed. Never had a spirometry done. Simple breathing test done. And for the first time, they crash into the hospital, maybe after a virus or a flu or something, and have an exacerbation of their COPD. So this is probably really one of the most difficult things. And as you see the next bullet there, 12 million patients remain undiagnosed in this country. They have it. These are estimates by the CDC that a tremendous number of people. Well, if you think about that, 12 million have it, don't know it. 15 million have it and do know it. That's over, what is it, over 25 million, 27 million people. Wow, that's a huge, huge chunk of asthma, of COPD. I also like to remind the residents that about 25 million people have asthma. That's 50 million people who have airway disease, that's a huge, huge chunk of the country. So we are obviously in lung disease very, very busy and will remain busy for many, many years. You can see that, unfortunately, many clinicians are not aware of these GOLD guidelines, and few of you even have read it, and that's why hopefully I'm here today to remind everybody. So here's the outline of my discussion today. We're going to talk about that new definition of COPD. What the heck does that mean? We'll talk a bit about staging of COPD. Everybody knows about the FEV1, the lung function test, forced expiratory volume 1 second. We've been using it for decades. We got something new, better, and I think much more helpful, and it drives treatment. We'll talk about those treatment algorithms. We'll talk about issues relating to delivery devices, something very important in airway disease. A new study on oxygen therapy for COPD that is very, very different and change our thinking about how we use oxygen. We'll talk about a new concept, just brand new, of something called de-escalation. We know that many times patients, because they're so symptomatic, they're so short of breath, that they get this medicine and this medicine and this medicine. Are they really necessary? And really, what are the best medicines? And we'll talk about this concept of, no, they don't need everything. De-escalate. And then, lastly, the acute exacerbation of COPD. So here is the typical definition of COPD, common and preventable and treatable disease. What other definition can you think of that starts out by saying that it's treatable and preventable? And the GOLD committee wanted to make sure that this was upfront. Why? Because, number one, it was not very treatable until really recent years, and now we do have good medicines that help symptoms, quality of life. And in years past, it was a kind of a nihilistic approach. We gave them theophylline, which made them sick, and didn't really do very much, a little bit of help. So we wanted to make sure that that the world knew that it was preventable and treatable, and of course preventable. I mean, we'll discuss the major causes of COPD, and they are indeed, in many instances, preventable. So characterized by persistent airflow limitation that's progressive. Well, that's the obstructive lung disease, and we'll see that the reason for that is an enhanced chronic inflammatory response of the airways. What we've known about asthma and inflammation for a long time, and it wasn't really until this first definition, when the GOLD guidelines came out in 2001, that it was recognized that, yeah, this is an inflammatory disease of the lungs too, and different cells, different mechanisms, but clearly inflammation is important and part of it. To noxious particles and gases, obviously the noxious particles and gases, cigarette smoke, and exacerbations and comorbidities contribute to overall severity. Well, that's up until 2015. Let me show you what happened. Of course, the abnormal inflammatory response is cigarette smoking, certainly in this country. But one of the things that we need to recognize is, especially with the tremendous number of immigrants that we have from underserved areas, that many have, especially women, have had exposure to burning of fossil fuels. This is how they cook. This is how they heat their abodes. So that many times where you have an enclosed space, you're burning, in this case, wood, animal dung. I mean, these are various things have been used to heat that the constant inhalation. As a matter of fact, this is really one of the leading causes of death. I just came back from India 2 weeks ago and learned that actually it is COPD is the leading cause of death there, and more women are dying. One of the curious things about the exposure to the fossil fuel is it's really more of that chronic bronchitis type of pattern than it is emphysema, but they still die from terrible airway disease. So this is the abnormal inflammatory response to these two products mainly. But let me show you what happened. In 2017 and 2018, the guidelines, same definition, but put something interesting in there. They said it's due to airway and alveolar abnormalities, usually caused by significant exposure to noxious particles and gases. Usually? Well, what's the unusually? When don't you have exposure to cigarettes or noxious particles like fossil fuel inhalation? Well, the answer has come out recently, and it's absolutely fascinating what has been discovered. The first thing is you sometimes will meet a patient who has COPD, and you say, well, how long have you been smoking? Oh, I never smoked. Oh, you must have had a lot of exposure. Your husband smoked, your wife smoked, parents. No, nobody smoked in our family. and yet bad COPD. So how does this happen? Well, here is a traditional view of COPD. This tobacco smoke, the air pollution, occupational and so forth, causing the inflammation, causing the two major contributions. On the left, chronic bronchitis in the smaller airways, inflammation, remodeling, mucus, and so forth. And on the right, parenchymal destruction, actual lung destruction, loss of alveolar attachment, decrease of elastic recoil. COPD is small airway, chronic bronchitis, on the right, emphysema. And this is what we've known. But something curious has popped up in our understanding of diseases of the childhood. And indeed, there's evidence that inflammation in the lungs can cause small airway diseases, which would then, later in life, predispose to COPD. The first thing that was recognized was childhood asthma. And a fascinating study was done in the early 2000s that was called the CAMP study, C-A-M-P, Childhood Asthma Management Program. So it was a study that was prospectively done. We're going to look at little kiddies from age 6, actually you'll see from up to age 18, and see what happens with lung growth. And one of the things they found is overall, they found that about 25% of children, by the time they reach 18, had abnormal lung function. That there was something that was happening with that inflammation of asthma that was causing bad lungs. The other thing they found is, you can see here, that this is much more prominent in boys than it was in girls. The boys in the black and the girls in the lighter. There. A study was done to follow up that you see here. It was done by age 18, and they compared the CAMP people, childhood asthma management, to, this is the H6CS, this is a community study of Harvard Health. And you can see here, looking in this case at FEV1 or FEC, this is a measure of airflow obstruction, that these kids with asthma had lower lung function, evidence of airway obstruction by age 18, and this was both girls and boys. Wow, this is sad. One out of four or five kids, by the time they're 18 years old, has, compared to other children their age, abnormal lung function. Well, what about adults? Well, this was a study in the New England Journal a couple of years ago. I've just shown male non-smokers, the same thing in women, no asthma, asthma, that overall, that many with asthma, not all patients, this is an average, will drop their FEV1, drop their lung function more than their non-asthmatic male counterparts. A 60-year-old male will have an FEV1, forced expiratory volume in 1 second, of 3 liters versus 199 in a similar asthmatic. That asthma, childhood, asthma, adulthood, can also lead to decreased lung function. Then there was a most amazing study that I think I've ever read that was done. The study was done on 2-month-old children. 2 months. How the heck do you measure lung function in a 2-month-old child? Absolutely amazing. They put a mask on the kid, and they actually had this gadget they could put on the chest to squeeze the chest. Now, of course, you know that children have a very pliable chest wall, and when they squeezed it, air came out. And when the air came out, they could measure it, and they could actually measure flow in these 2-month-old kids. And then what they did is, you'll see on the right there, they put them into quartiles. Quartiles of infants, low lung function all the way to high lung function. Let me show you what they found. It was absolutely fascinating. What they found in the bottom line there, you see, is that there were some kids that were born with absolutely low lung function, and follow them, look at that, up to age 22. I mean, amazing study. They followed these kids, and what do they find? That by age 22, these kids remained with abnormal lung function. Something was happening in utero, obviously, with the 2-month-old. Something was happening in utero, whether it was the cigarette-smoking mother, whether it was mother having infections, perhaps viral infections. Nobody really understands, but this was got a little trouble with the computer, maybe. Is this it? No, sorry here. Here we go. Good. We're okay. So this was it. And, of course, those with relatively normal function remained with normal function. So what's the lesson here? Well, I think the lesson is, yeah, COPD is clearly a disease of the cigarette smoker and clearly the disease of exposure to fossil fuel. But we know that air pollution, thank you, air pollution, childhood asthma, prematurity or abnormalities even in utero seem to cause abnormal lung function. And this is a totally new concept. So here is our latest thinking about COPD, as you see from the New England Journal 2015, that there are some individuals who are exposed to mainly cigarette smoke, of course, will have a rapid decline of lung function. You see here, but look at that, at age 18, 20, they have normal lung function. Others seem to have very abnormal lung function, even starting at early adulthood. And again, if they're on the slippery slope, the darker line there, they will then develop COPD. And as a matter of fact, if you look, you'll see in this article that about half of the COPD patients who were discovered had low FEV1 before age 40. So obviously, low lung function at an earlier age, whatever the cause, is clearly a risk factor for COPD. And yes, the cigarette smoker is obviously the number one cause, but there are obviously many others. So there are some conclusions. Low lung function early in life is an important risk factor for COPD development. A combination of rapid COPD decline, let's say in a smoker or someone who's exposed also, starting with low lung function is even worse. Asthma at an early age may be associated with a rapid decline of lung function, and a combination of asthma and starting at low lung function may lead to fixed airway obstruction that's quite severe. So low lung function, starting at early life, asthma resulting in fixed airway obstruction later in life, no exposure to noxious stimuli, cigarettes, fossil fuel. Is that COPD? Well, I don't know that there's an answer to that. And I think that you'll see some people in the literature saying, oh, that's a COPD, fixed airway obstruction. And others will say, no, asthma's not COPD. Asthma's asthma with fixed airway obstruction. So the argument will go on, but I thought it would be interesting for you to see that, indeed, you will see patients who've never had cigarette smoke, and probably this is the reason why they're COPD. So our current view is that this phenotype of chronic bronchitis, the inflammation of the small airways, the phenotype of emphysema, the destruction of alveolar attachments, is probably now thought to be just one disease. We approach it, COPD, as one single disease. But that's probably not going to last for long. And the reason is because of the asthma world again. COPD seems to kind of follow discoveries with asthma. We are recognizing now that not all asthma is the same, that some people with asthma respond really well to, for example, inhaled corticosteroids. Others don't. Some people with asthma have very mild disease. Some have aspirin-sensitive disease and so forth. And it's the recognition that asthma has many different phenotypes, different expressions of asthma, and probably many different endotypes, meaning the mechanism of disease, a physiologic mechanism. And now there's intense research that's looking at COPD saying, hey, we've been talking about this as just one disease. Is it really one disease, or perhaps are there many different phenotypes and very many endotypic pathways? We don't know yet, but this is kind of a little bit of the future. We're beginning to learn, and some of the things I'll talk about in a minute may give you that insight. So a single disease, as we say now. So one of the things that we've done for a long, long time is when we see, in most diseases, we stage the disease. Is it bad? Is it severe? Very severe? And so forth. And indeed, this was the schema that we've used now for decades. I'll show you decades. That we look at the FEV1, the amount that you exhale out in 1 second. Obviously, if you've got obstructed airways, you don't get very much out in that first second, so the percent that's predicted for your age and your height is low. And we see that if you have 80% or greater, your stage one, very mild, 50 to 80, moderate, and so forth. I didn't memorize this, so what did I do? I am trying to make things simple for myself. I looked at this number, 50%. If you're less than 50% predicted on FEV1, you're either severe or very severe. That's bad disease. You're going to be symptomatic. You're going to have, you need medicine and so forth. So make it easy. 50% FEV1 predicted. You're below that, you're a hurting buckaroo. This is something, you got to do something about this patient. Now, there's one little caveat here, and that is you have to have airflow obstruction. How do we define airflow obstruction? Well, at least through the guidelines, we look at that ratio of FEV1 over FVC. So the forced vital capacity is the total amount you get out. If you don't get out very much in 1 second, the ratio is going to be very low, the amount that you get out in 1 second compared to the total. So we look at that FEV1 over FVC. You and I would probably at least get 70, 75, 80, 80% of our breath out in 1 second. Easy to blow it out. But the obstructed airway, the COPD airway, has a tough time getting that out. So that ratio goes down. So you got to be less than 70%. So here is why it became so important. That if you look at the FEV1, greater than 50, 40, 30, less than 30, you can see that clearly the FEV1 predicts mortality. Now, this is a study that you can see in the bottom there, 1986, and we've known this for really for decades. And indeed, this was repeated with more recent studies, excuse me, the NHANES study, the National Health Nutrition study done by the CDC, and the same things. You know, the worse your COPD, the worse your mortality. Well, as we began looking at the FEV1 and its prediction, we found two other things, that there was a very weak correlation between the number and symptoms and health status. Well, that's what patients care about. You know, you hear patients saying, I don't care how long I'm going to live, but I want to live well, and I want to live healthy, and I want to live with good quality of life. That's what is important to patients. But yet this FEV1 number didn't really predict and give a good assessment of those important parameters in patients. So what did the GOLD guidelines do? They gave us a new classification, which at first was a little more complicated. Here's the down and dirty on it, a very simple classification of A, B, C, D. Now, I looked at this in first, and honestly, gosh, for 2 years I didn't use it because it's too complicated. But it really became actually very easy when I looked very carefully. Okay. The first thing you do look at is on the left-hand column, you measure, okay, something that's called the MMRC, and I'll show you what that is in a section. It's very easy, okay. If you're on the left-hand column, the MMRC is low, and you don't have very much in the way of symptoms. If you're in B or D, you do have a lot of symptoms, and you're going to be in one of these columns. Now, what differentiate A and B and C and D is exacerbations. You know, those flare-ups of acute bronchitis that require antibiotics, steroids, and so forth. We'll discuss those in a second. If you have two or more of those, or if you have one hospitalization, you're in the upper column, you're a C and D. So you got two parameters, symptoms, and have you had exacerbations over the last year. That's pretty easy to look at. So what is this symptom? What is this MMRC, and what's that CAT score? The CAT stands for COPD Assessment Test. It's a 10-question questionnaire. I don't use it. You're never going to use it. It's a research tool because it's just too complicated. It takes too much time. But the MMRC, the Modified Medical Research Council scale, is a real easy one. If you're two or greater, then you're in the B or D on the right-hand column. So what is two or greater? On a level ground, I walk slower than people my age, or I have to stop for breath walking at my own pace. So you say, can you walk to the car? Can you walk your dog? Oh, no, I don't walk my dog anymore because I have too short of breath. I have to stop every so many feet or so. That's stage two. Now, obviously, if you're too breathless, you can't leave the house. Stage four, that's obviously very, very severe. But if you're two or more, you're in that right-hand column. So let's practice. All right, let's say that you were caring for a 55-year-old male, 40-pack years smoking, risk factor, has daily smoker's cough, chronic bronchitis, needs antibiotics two or three times in the past for winter, and a spring chest cold, exacerbations, had to stop walking because of breathlessness after a few minutes on level ground, at least a two or more. So here's his lung function studies on the bottom. FEV1 is 82% predicted. FE1 over FEC, 71, post-bronchodilator, which is the study we do. We have to give them a short-acting bronchodilator, and we then test it, 72% there. So COPD risk factor, yeah, smoking. Chronic bronchitis history, yep. Exacerbations, he had two in the last year. He's a grade 3 MMRC. What's his GOLD stage? Well, I tricked you. He doesn't have airflow obstruction. His FEV1 was normal. It was a greater than 70%. But he was symptomatic. And he looked like he had COPD, sounded like he had COPD. But because this one number, he doesn't have COPD. Well, there are two articles that I'm going to show you that are really absolutely fascinating. And I know I've seen these patients over and over again. I've helped these patients over and over again because I recognize what they had. The first came out in JAMA Internal Medicine. They looked at a group of people who had the smoking history but had that FEV1% greater than 70%. And they said, okay, you got the risk factor. You got the risk factor. Did I miss something here? Hang on, no. Okay. You got the risk factor. They found that these patients, compared to non-smokers, they didn't have airflow obstruction, had worse quality of life, lower six-minute walk distance, had evidence of emphysema or airway thickening on their CAT scan. And this JAMA Internal Medicine said there are 35 million current former smokers older than 55 who may have unrecognized disease or impairment. So it's that risk factor leading to those changes in the lungs that lead to the symptoms but not quite airflow obstruction enough to cause it to cause COPD. Well, there's a study that called the spiromic study, and not just a totally different group, cohort group. Ever or former smokers compared to never smokers with normal FEV1 over FEV1%, didn't have COPD by guidelines. The cutoff score of 10 or greater for that CAT was observed. In half of them, the mucus hypersecretion, a third of them, they had significantly less physical activity, lower lung function, more respiratory exacerbations, and their CAT scans were consistent with emphysema and airway wall thickening. So who are these people? Well, there are people who come to you symptomatic. They may have a little more shortness of breath. They may have a little bit of cough. They may be former smokers or active smokers. And they are absolutely symptomatic. And if you really tested them, like they did in the study, you'd find abnormalities. So what do they also find? That many of these patients were treated with COPD medications and improved. Actually got better. So I think it's important to recognize this. Now, curiously enough, this was a category of COPD until about 10 years ago when they said gold stage zero were these people, symptomatic, chronic cough, smoking history. But they said, but they don't have COPD, so we got rid of gold zero. Well, there obviously is a gold zero, and it's these patients here. Symptomatic, yes, airflow obstruction, not quite enough to make a COPD, absolutely symptomatic. And if you look carefully, they have emphysema on their CAT scans. They have evidence of chronic bronchitis. Let's talk about therapeutics. Well, the first thing that I kind of have to remind myself every time I see a new patient, the choice of inhaler device will depend upon availability, cost, the prescribing physician, skills, and ability of the patients. It's essential to ensure that the inhaler technique is correct and recheck this at every visit. Inhalation barriers can lead to undertreatment or unintentional. This is Gold, 2017. Now, I'm going to challenge you to look at the next patient, whatever your specialty is, who comes in and says, oh, I have a COPD or maybe asthma or something. Oh, really? Do you have your inhaler with you? Oh, I keep it with me all the time. Oh, really? Why don't you take it out and show me how you use it? Well, I'm going to say certainly if over age, let's say 60 or 70, the likelihood of them using it correctly is going to be maybe 1 out of 10. They'll take it out. They may forget to shake it a little bit. That's okay. They may forget to take the cap off. That's not okay. They may put it in their mouth. They may keep it out here. I've seen people just squeezing out here, and it winds up on their face. Or the most common thing that I see, which is it's really is priceless. Patient takes their meter out. They're shaking it. They continue to shake. You know, it's like one shake is okay, but boy, I mean, 20 or 30 shakes, that really is going to make this work well. And then they put it in their mouth. They take a deep breath in, and then they pump. And you see the medicine flying out from all directions because they're not breathing deeply. So meter dose inhaler use, and this is where often we give them a spacer, and they come in and, where's your spacer? Oh, I left it at home. It's in my desk drawer. You know, they often don't use it. So I think it is important to observe patients. Newer devices with the dry powder inhalers that we use, interesting. You open, you click. It's really easy stuff to do. But, boy, if you're really severe disease, you can't take that deep breath in. that is necessary because what the powder is, you've got to have enough flow to break up the particles and deposit it into your lungs. So watch them do it. Ask them to demonstrate. Maybe have, if you're seeing enough patients, these little dummy devices with placebo in your desk drawer to even demonstrate yourself, to show them exactly, and watch them do it. This has really become a very, very big problem, and which is really, honestly, why elderly people, frail and so forth, I send them home with a nebulizer because I know that they're going to do that, and they kind of like that. And it's also good for an acute exacerbation if they have it. So enough said about that. Got to keep an eye on time. So it's important using inhaler devices correctly. How to deal with the poor adherence is now emphasized. 68% do not use their inhaler well enough to benefit from prescribed medicine. These are study after study. About 50%, you'll forgive me, crew, of internal medicine specialist residents did not know the correct use of steps when using most common devices. Even my fellows, you know, they just don't think of it. But now you're thinking, and now you're going to actually watch your patients do it and make sure that they do it correctly. So let's talk a little bit about the treatment algorithms. Well, as I said, this ABCD has become important because it just shows you what you need to treat the patient with. And it's an interesting little guideline. It's easy to do. Let's say you have a patient in A. What is A? Not very symptomatic and has not had exacerbations. Hey, probably doesn't need very much. Occasionally, they may need a short-acting beta agonist or short-acting anticholinergic like ipratropium as needed. If they're noticing, gee, I don't like to walk my dog in the morning because I do get short of breath, I can't go as far, then maybe you'll give them a long-acting bronchodilator, either an anticholinergic or a long-acting beta agonist. So that's A. B, I'm getting more and more symptomatic. All right. I've already tried maybe tiotropium, which is an anticholinergic. You step up. What do you step up to? Give them new LABA-LAMA combinations. There are four of them now that are out with a long-acting beta agonist and long-acting anticholinergic. Step up care. These combination bronchodilators work well. There are some of them are 24-hour others are 12-hour. It's really up to you, the patient, and their desires. Let's say now that we have a patient who's now beginning to say, gee, I had two attacks of bronchitis. You know, I had to go to the walk-in clinic twice this year and get antibiotics, and they even gave me some prednisone the last time. Well, they've had an exacerbation of their COPD. Now they're either in group C or D. If they're not very symptomatic, you probably ought to give them a LABA or LABA-LABA. You should give them a bronchodilator. Why? Because I'm going to show you in a second how you prevent these exacerbations. These bronchodilators work. They prevent exacerbations. Not all of them, but they're very effective in reducing the rates of exacerbations. So by the time you're having these flare-ups, and it's a simple question, have you had in the last year or two a visit to the walk-in center, to the urgent care, to your personal physician for, quote, you know, the patient will say, my winter bronchitis? Oh, yeah, that's their exacerbation of COPD. And if they've had it at least two or more times, or especially the residents, you're discharging a patient from the hospital, that's group D, one hospitalization, so they ought to be, as you see in group D, actually three medicines, LABA, LAMA, and also this is when the inhaled corticosteroid is used. Now, it may not be used forever, as I'll describe in a second, but that's how we use it. Other medications I'll discuss in a second, preventive medications. But this is the schema, and it's pretty simple. You start with simple stuff, as needed. You increase it to one long-acting bronchodilator, more symptomatic, two long-acting bronchodilators. Now they're in combinations and various delivery devices, usually dry powders. And then you step up to the inhaled corticosteroid when they're most severe. So let's talk about oxygen. Everybody uses oxygen therapy correctly when the O2 saturation, as you see here, is either PaO2 is less than 55 or the O2 saturation is 88% or below. Simple, easy. And you call the home care and they come out and they deliver oxygen to the family, to the home. There is a little caveat if you have pulmonary hypertension or peripheral edema, congestive heart failure, yeah, you can lower that O2 saturation a little bit and the PaO2 of 60%. So, yes, this is oxygen at rest. Everybody uses it correctly. This is Medicare guidelines that have been available for decades. But what often happens is that the nurse or some assistant says to the patient, "Ah, good news, you're being discharged today. Let's take a walk down the corridor." And they put the oximeter on, and it goes to 86. And they say, "Oh, got to let the doctor know that they have low oxygen. You need to go home with oxygen." Well, is that really necessary? Well, for years, we gave oxygen because, you know, on the Medicare form, you know, check off, rest, exercise, sleep. Yeah, exercise. Well, a huge study was done, well done, that asked the question, does it matter? Do you really need to send this patient home on oxygen 24 hours a day, tripping over their wires, seeing them in the office in two weeks as a follow-up, and you come in and they say, "Oh, where's your oxygen tank?" "Oh, I left it at home. I left it in the car in the heat." You hear all kinds of things. So the answer is you obviously want to give it when you really, really is necessary, not just as needed. So here's the answer why. Study came out in the New England Journal showing oxygen during exercise and sleep, oxygen, no oxygen in these patients who desaturated with exercise, absolutely no difference. No difference in hospitalization, quality of life, all the parameters that they measure. So, no, you don't need to give that patient oxygen when they run down the hall of the hospital just before discharge and they desaturate. Yes, maybe if it's in the 70s, then they probably don't even have COPD as a cause. They may have other concomitant illnesses like interstitial lung disease. But just recognize this mild desaturation in the 80s, they don't need oxygen. It's not going to make a difference. So let's briefly talk about this, and I'm going to leave some time for questions, this de-escalation. Gold says, now we suggest escalation and de-escalation strategies with resolution of some symptoms that maybe subsequently require less treatment. But, caveat, we know that there is really no systematically tested study for this de-escalation. And trials are really only include inhaled corticosteroids, and we really don't know, honestly, when to use and when not to use. But there are some new guidelines that have come out. So, the first time we recognized that, gee, maybe all this inhaled corticosteroid that we've been using for now decades, maybe it's not necessary. You know, you've got COPD, what do you put them on? An inhaled steroid and a bronchodilator. It used to be LABA ICS. Remember the discs and so forth? We used to use lots of these medications. And that was the standard. And this trial was the first to sort of question this and said, gee, guys, maybe we don't need all this steroid. What they did is it was a 12-month study with severe patients. These are not mild patients. They took them off their steroid, and they left them on their combination long-acting beta agonist and long-acting anticholinergic. Withdrawal did not increase exacerbations. There was a slight decrease in lung function, not enough that we really would worry about. But, and they reported this, and then they went back and they looked at their data and say, gee, wow, we found a subgroup here of patients that did have more exacerbations. And who were those patients? These are patients that had eosinophils in their peripheral blood, greater than 300 cells per microliter. So there was a signal here. Now, you all know that, you know, the neutrophilic bronchitis, COPD, eosinophilic bronchitis, asthma. So the question was, were they seeing asthma in these patients? Well, they didn't have any history of asthma, and they weren't atopic. They didn't have the typical asthma background, but they had a lot of the eosinophils. Well, studies now are beginning to recognize that there is, and this is what I was saying earlier, this phenotype of COPD, this group over here, that seems to have a lot of eosinophils in their peripheral blood. They don't necessarily have asthma. But they also seem to respond better to inhaled corticosteroids. And this is where. So, blood eosinophil counts may predict the efficacy of ICS in preventing exacerbation in patients with COPD. Obviously, we still to this day need prospective studies. In patients certainly with low blood eosinophil counts, less than 2%, there is evidence for poor response to inhaled corticosteroids and increased risk of pneumonia. Now, most of the time, we tell patients we use these inhaled corticosteroids, they're pretty safe. Yeah, do we have studies from 2, 3, 4 years? Oh, yeah, we have studies. Do we have studies for 40 years? I got COPD when I was 45, 50 years old. I'm going to take it for decades. What does it do to you? We have no idea what inhale. So obviously, less is best. And if you really need it, yes. If you're an asthmatic, absolutely. But if you're a COPD patient, yes, if you have a lot of eosinophils in your peripheral blood. So look back on the chart. I'm sure they've had admissions, or they're obviously remembering that oral corticosteroids drop the eosinophil counts to probably zero, so you can't look at the values that were done on oral corticosteroids. But it's important to recognize that, indeed, blood eosinophil count may predict who needs inhaled corticosteroids. So final few minutes, let's talk about the acute exacerbation of COPD. We know that there's always a day-to-day variation in all of us. Well, you feel great today and tomorrow a little achy. But what happens is if there's deterioration beyond the normal day-to-day variation with cough, phlegm, expectoration, yellow change in the sputum, a more shortness of breath, wheezing, I feel congested, and so forth, this is the exacerbation. At least 60, probably more, percent of patients who have an exacerbation of COPD have a virus. The most common virus that causes this, rhinovirus. Well, that's the most common cold virus. This is what we all will get in a winter cold. So this is what a COPD patient get. Are there other, yes, rhinovirus, respiratory syncytial virus sometimes. Obviously, influenza, yeah. Parainfluenza, yes. So respiratory viruses, for the most part, drive most of these exacerbations. Now, one of the things that we're recognizing about these, quote, bronchitis attacks in the winter is that there are a lot of really bad outcomes. And I show you some fascinating work about why we think this is. But lower quality of life, increased inflammation, faster disease progression, mortality rates are higher if you get these exacerbations, more risk of future exacerbations, likelihood of a hospitalization. Look at this risk. This is a fascinating slide. If you have one or two of these exacerbations, look at the relative risk of having a third or a fourth or a fifth or a sixth. I mean, this is the frequent exacerbator. This is the person who you see in the hospital over and over and over again. This is the one that's going to cause your hospital administrators heartburn because they realize that these are the patients who are getting readmitted within 30 days and are causing the hospital to have financial consequences. So what works? Well, long-acting bronchodilators, look at this, absolutely. Salmeterol, tiotropium, commonly used drugs for COPD, exacerbation rates will drop. The famous TORCH trial, looking at both LABA and ICS together. If it's one or two or the bronchodilator or the steroid, yes, there's a reduction, but the combination together. This led to widespread use of the LABA ICS. But, yes, it works. Again, that group D patients that we talked about. Macrolides are coming out now. There's these two studies, a third study from Europe that came out, giving 500 milligrams of azithromycin Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Big drop, as you see here, in exacerbation rate. Does it cause a lot of emerging resistance in organisms? For some reason, it doesn't, looking carefully. What are the problems? Obviously, QTC interval. Make sure you check the cardiogram. And unfortunately, I've seen now two patients in the last few months, hearing loss. You want to monitor that carefully. Maybe get an audiogram before you begin. But it does reduce exacerbations. And actually, patients feel much better on it. Then the last kid on the block is something called roflumilast. It's a PDE4, phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor, and significant reduction in exacerbations, especially when added to a LABA or the most recent study, LABA ICS. So it does reduce exacerbation rate. Big problem with this medicine is it causes a lot of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, GI complaints. However, the company finally got smart. They now have a new pill instead of the 500 microgram pill. There's a 250. Start them out with a low dose for a month or two and then go up to the higher dose, and it's much better tolerated. So roflumilast, adding to the armamentarium. Pulmonary rehab, sadly enough, many centers don't even have rehab. We don't even have it at Mount Sinai Hospital. It's expensive to run, and the reimbursement is so horrible that many, many institutions do not have rehab. But clearly, you can see here in the three studies and overall, it reduces hospitals' unplanned admissions. And patient education, having your respiratory therapist go to the bedside, go over these inhaler techniques, talk a little bit about adherence, which is a big problem in any disease, but certainly in COPD. And it works. Reduces admissions, ED visits, and so forth. So, here is an important thing, though, a la the hospital readmission problem. Numerous strategies have been proposed to combat high rates, including the use of discharge bundles, at-home programs, telemedicine, telerehabilitation. No single best strategy has been emerged. So, try them all. Here is a very fascinating point that I want to make the last few minutes. If you look at COPD, you say, oh, there's a guy with lung disease, right? Interestingly enough, if you look at his blood tests, you'll find simple tests that measure inflammation of the body go up and up and up. CRP, C-reactive protein. Look at this in severe COPD. TNF-alpha, tumor necrosis factor alpha, a clear pro-inflammatory mediator. And it goes on. I'll measure some of the others. That there seems to be in the blood these inflammatory markers. What the heck is happening? Is the inflammation in the lungs seeping out into the blood and streaming around? Well, probably yes. As a matter of fact, as a result of this, many of the common diseases of older individuals are much more common in the COPD patient. Anemia of chronic disease, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, osteoporosis, muscle wasting, and so forth, certainly cardiovascular disease. And if you look at the levels of CRP, interleukin 6, fibrinogen, and other nonspecific markers of inflammation, white counts, TNF-alpha, the relationship to these comorbidities is profound. So it does seem to be the smoking gun, that there really is something that's happening in the lungs that's spilling out into the blood that is causing these other pro-inflammatory illnesses. I mean, coronary artery disease, clearly a pro-inflammatory illness. So this is the long list of common abnormalities seen in the COPD patient. One of the most fascinating ones of all. Look at the one over there that says anxiety and depression. Do you know that if you look at a group of people with COPD and measure, for example, IL-6 or CRP, or one of the inflammatory mediators, and look at them with depression and no depression, it's elevated in depression, thinking that maybe this is another driver of depression. Well, inflammation also predicts mortality. IL-6, neutrophils, fibrinogen, look at the profound effect that it has on mortality that you see on the bottom line there. What do they patients die from? Well, with all these comorbidities, they don't only die of COPD. You see about a third of them do cancer, lung cancer, cardiovascular disease. As a matter of fact, for every 10% decrease in FEV1, cardiovascular mortality increases by about 28%. Wow. So this is the comorbidity. Well, the last slide, I want to make it positive, but the truth of the matter is many patients with COPD don't hit this spiral. The truth is that many do. We don't really know why some people, cigarette smoke identified early, just don't have this slippery slope. Others, stop smoking too, will have this slippery slope. But as you can see, the more airflow obstruction, continued smoking, exacerbations, alveolar destruction, hypoxemia later in life, and eventually a death either from COPD or a comorbidity. So, in summary, I've shown you some new grading for COPD, the severity indices. Remember, A, very mild, B, and clearly you want to treat those symptomatic patients. C, not so symptomatic, but having exacerbations. They clearly need that treatment to prevent exacerbations. And D, yes, throw the book at them. These are patients that are obviously severe, having frequent exacerbation. Emphasis on inhaler technique, we talked about. Oxygen for arresting hypoxemia, no. De-escalates, yes, certainly A to C patients except with eosinophilia, and exacerbations can be prevented, certainly medications, rehab, patient education, and with that I will say thank you for this kind invitation. I love being here. Happy to answer any questions. Please, first one.
Yeah.
Well, in answer to that first question, personal responsibility is a major, major issue as we look at the obesity problem. We look at all you have to do is drive on Florida roads here and see these cars zipping in and out, causing crashes. And indeed, this has been looked at in COPD, and you're absolutely hitting the right tone, that clearly poor adherence has been shown to not only worsen symptoms, worsen quality of life, cause hospitalizations and even mortality. So there is evidence that, and it's very high, the non-adherence in COPD. Why? Because it's any chronic disease. I don't want to take it. I hit my donut hole. I didn't remember. I feel better today, so I didn't take it. And expenses are very big one. Yes. Yeah. Please. There was a second question. Yeah, that's a great one. There was a syndrome that was described about 5 or so years ago, and they decided it wasn't a syndrome. They called it ACOS, Asthma COPD Overlap Syndrome, and they took the S off, and now it's ACO. So there is a group of people. Remember I mentioned about the phenotypes, that we're going to start emerging new phenotypes. This is one of the newer phenotypes of the COPD patient, where you have asthma and COPD. So how do you define it? Well, interestingly enough, the GOLD committee said, we don't know. There is no definite one test that defines it. However, there are criteria, and you're absolutely right. If indeed that patient has a history of asthma, has a high IgE level, especially has had asthma diagnosis before age 40. Why? Because there's no COPD before age 40. So that would be an important one, a high eosinophil count. And the studies have shown these people have higher exacerbation rates, poorer quality of life, higher hospitalizations, and respond to corticosteroids. So that's why it's important to define that specific entity. The other thing is, now it's being looked at, is the new biologics for asthma being given to COPD patients and them working. Not because they got COPD, because they have asthma. So that's another. Please, sir. Yeah, well, a little prayer. It's just a constant a reminder to patients. The favorite approach, obviously, is using the nicotine replacement up to Wellbutrin. It's been used. Varenicline, I've used a lot. I don't know. I just I sit and I plead with patients and. Good question. The British health committees just about a month or two or three ago came out with a recommendation that the electronic cigarette, the vaping, is a good way to stop smoking cigarettes. They endorsed it. Here we're going, oh my God, are you kidding me? Number one. There are carcinogens and other things in this, and what they've shown, at least in studies here, is that, yes, especially in kids, it is a forerunner of smoking real cigarettes. I mean, in other words, a greater rate of kids who begin to smoke cigarettes who have been vaping as opposed to those who never vaped at all. So I think that the bottom line is get rid of them. It is a successful way to stop in many patients, but on the negative side, as a society, I think we would rather not have them with us. Please.
Anything new on the genetics of obstructive lung disease, asthma, emphysema, lung cancer, linking them, or helping to sort out who's going to develop what?
Yeah, well, I really wish that were the case. You know, after the alpha-1 antitrypsin discovery, everybody said, oh, God, there's probably a lot of other genes, and they really have not been found. I wish there were things that are going to predict, but so far there's no bullet. Please. Yeah, The question is particularly relevant in obviously underserved world where the mother is exposed to these noxious agents. In this country, I think it's just being worked out exactly what are some of the mechanisms. Certainly, there are certain nutritional deficiencies. Vitamin D, for example, deficiency has been shown. So good nutrition during pregnancy. Exposure to secondhand smoke would be another reason, with the oxidative stress that probably is causing changes. This is just newly discovered and a new exciting area of research. A lot of it, interestingly enough, being done in Africa because of the exposures to the cooking fuels. So I don't know. Tune in. It'd be a great area for research for you. Okay, one more, yeah, please.
Have you been using new generic drugs now available for treatment?
Yeah, the answer is I just started writing them about a week or two ago because they were just approved, 2 weeks ago or so. But now there is a generic LABA ICS. Actually, what it is, they've been advertising as a generic Advair. Advair being a drug that's been around for, about 25 or so years. And the first iteration from one company, I can't remember which one, was rejected. But just recently, the generic has been accepted. It looks the same. It's a disc, I think, and patients hopefully will be causing less. But, yes, I've been trying to use it. Let's hope there are more to come. Again, I thank you for your attention.